On Thursday, June 1st, we kicked off the month by talking to a couple of faculty members from the College of Nursing at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. They're going to be getting some federal money to educate future healthcare providers on how to alleviate pain without the use of opioids. Some of the trials are going to be done right here in Bridgeport. And also on the show, we talked to the commissioner of the Department of Administrative Services. That's a department that basically has to make sure the state runs on a day-to-day basis. Good news is he's trying to save some money. Paul Pacelli here, Aaron Johnson behind the glass. We're going to start talking this segment about a problem that we've talked about over and over and over again on this program, the problem of opioids and the overuse of such and the problem it's causing and what can folks do as far as seeking alternatives for pain relief. The good news is Sacred Heart University, the program there, has received a pretty big chunk of cash to try and look into this. And joining us right now, two guests, a pair of guests on this one. Professor Susan Danisco joins us. She's professor and director of Hybrid Doctor of Nursing Practice and the Family Nursing Practitioner Program at Sacred Heart University. Susan, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. I'm really excited to be here. And my colleague, yep. Dr. Carrie Milner, is here also.
Yes, Professor Carrie Milner is there as well. And you two were are key in this program. First of all, Susan or Carrie, the actual appropriating of the funds from the Health and Resources and Services Administration. How did you folks end up getting the money?
Well, you know, we sat down. This is a HRSA grant that is called for every year or every other year, depending on the funding from the government. And this program is really about training nurse practitioner students to be primary care providers. We know that primary care providers, in terms of physicians, there's a shortage of them mm-hmm. in the country, as well as in the Bridgeport area in the state of Connecticut. And so the grant, so part of the grant funding will go towards, it's called Advanced Nursing Education Workforce. We are going to be training our students at two federally qualified health centers in Bridgeport. And then the other half of the money is to look at and look at solutions in regards to prescribing opiates and to teach healthcare providers and clinical preceptors at the health centers to use alternative treatments to opioids for pain, because we know the opioid crisis in Connecticut is huge. Unfortunately, we are one of the top states that suffers from this. We're one of the top 10 states in the country mm-hmm. that has overdose deaths. In fact, I don't know, Dr. Milner, if you read in the paper this morning, there was an article in the Connecticut Post about the opioid crisis. And while Fairfield County has a lower amount of prescriptions that are sold, prescription opiates are sold through drugstores, we've had the most overdoses in Fairfield County, and specifically in Bridgeport.
Dr. Milner, you want to comment on that?
Sure. So like Dr. Danisco said, we are one of the top 10 states, unfortunately, for the reason of having the highest rates of opioid-related overdose deaths. Mm-hmm. And we've had a fourfold increase in overdoses. In 2016, it was 5.7
yeah.
and per 1,000 persons, and now it's up to 24.5 deaths per 100,000 persons.
Now,
whereas the national average is 13.3 deaths per 100,000 persons.
Carrie, back to you. You know, you hear and read, or maybe people out of your profession hear about alternative therapies for pain relief. What are some of those? I mean, I guess we're kind of brought up, you know, to give me some pain relief medicine. Give me something to kill the pain. I can't stand the pain. But what kind of modalities here are we looking at to try and maybe back off the opioids a little bit?
Sure. Paul, just to put it into perspective, in 2015, in the state of Connecticut, providers wrote $2.3 million scripts for opioid pain mm-hmm. relievers, which equates to 64 prescriptions for every 100 individuals.
Wow.
So we have to, you know, we have to find other sources. So I'm going to have my colleague, Dr. Danisco, give you some other modalities for pain than opioids.
So, Paul, I've been practicing as a nurse practitioner in Bridgeport for 30 years, and I work at a clinic on Fairfield Avenue. And so what I see is that pain is one of the most common reasons why people go to the doctor's office. And so we really try to discuss with patients and prescribe alternatives, meaning if, you know, a medication like ibuprofen or naproxen is one alternative that's commonly used. And then there are topical alternatives, capsaicin cream, lidocaine patches. We also use antidepressants now for people that have chronic pain.
Wow.
And as well as in, you know, other things like acupuncture, we refer patients for chiropractic care. We also work with a pain management center who will be our consulting partner on this grant up in Milford and Orange. Their name is New Solutions, and they see a lot of our patients for chronic pain care.
You know, Susan, it's interesting you mentioned the ibuprofen. I'm in the latter stages of getting a dental implant, getting it, you know, which is an extraction of a putting in of a of an abutment there, then the final crown. And the doctor I went to after I had the actual implant put in, he did not give me any opioids. He gave me ibuprofen, and I asked him, "Is this suitable?" He said, "Well, in this case, it's every bit as good in your case as an opioid, so why should I do that when it's just ibuprofen?" Which, you know, made me, I was happy with that, you know?
And that's, Paul, that's really nice to hear, because that's one of the, you know, things that we're trying to change, you know, dentist practice, you know, what kind of things do they prescribe for pain control? And the other thing that you could use, too, is ice.
Yeah.
No, they told me that. They told me that.
Yeah.
Carrie, did it just get to the point where the opioid prescription thing was just a little, was it too easy? And is that the kind of thing that set us off on the course we're on? And is that what you're trying to tell up and coming nurses and nurse practitioners here to rethink? Because sometimes things that are easy are not the best.
Sure. So how we got to where we got is multifactorial and is too big to cover in our little segment here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can cover, you know, what can we do now that we know that we have a problem? And so by us partnering with Southwest and Optimist, two federally qualified health centers, and New Solutions, which is, you know, what's happening now is primary care providers are the pendulum has kind of swung the other way, and they are careful about how they prescribe opioids. And so New Solutions has filled this gap in practice that a primary care provider who has someone who has opioid misuse or abuse can refer them to New Solutions, and they will manage that for the provider, because it is extensive what they have to do with this patient population. There has to be contracts with the patient.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be urine screenings to make sure that they are upholding their end of the patient-provider contract.
Interesting. So this is being done, Professor Danisco, in a very deliberate way to make sure, I would imagine, that even though you're trying to introduce new modes and new ways of thinking here, the bottom line is the patient or patients, they still have pain, and you have to treat them for the pain that's maybe making part of their lives not pleasant.
Absolutely. And the pain is real to patients, and we understand and we believe that. And so it is difficult sometimes as a primary care provider to address the pain in the depth that we need to in a hurried 15-minute office visit. So by partnering and referring and using, you know, physical therapy and other modalities, the patients can have better pain control.
And, you know, whether it's folks like you who are trying this on a nursing level or an APRN level or whatever, or doctors, that's one of the things that's always fascinated me and made me realize how tough this is. Somebody comes to you or a doctor and says, "Well, I'm in pain. I hurt." well, how much is the pain? How bad do you hurt? Number one, you're trying to negotiate something, folks, that you're relying on somebody to A, describe something to you, and B, it's not like a bruise on person A is a bruise on person B. People, as you well know, have higher tolerances for what they consider bad pain, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And some of the patients are just at higher risk, like you were talking about pain tolerance, but they've had multiple things in their lives. They may have, you know, multiple comorbid factors. They're obese. They have diabetic neuropathy. They have osteoarthritis, degenerative joint disease. Maybe they had an old injury that was, you know, a back surgery several years ago, and they're still having pain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, it gets to be a very complex issue, and the patients do deserve the attention, the full attention of the primary care provider to be able to address this instead of just throwing a prescription for Percocet or Vicodin, which are two of the most abused drugs for non-cancer pain.
Absolutely. Carrie, are we still finding out even today as the years and the months go by of how addictive some of this stuff is? I mean, I just did a segment with the wife of a high school friend of mine who had a stepson addicted at 14 because he was getting treated for a football injury. And that sent him on a spiral that unfortunately ended in his death. We're still seeing some pretty nasty stuff about this, huh?
Sure, because providers can be slow to change.
Mm.
And if you've graduated from school and it's been many years and what you've trained under and what you've been taught, you continue to do. So now to unwind that and try to get people to try alternative methods to manage pain can be a challenge. And then the other thing too is that the flip side of that is that some patients come in and expect to have an opioid prescription. And so providers, there are excellent providers out there that are spending the time to educate people. And I think you must have seen someone for your dentist because you got, so the change will be slow.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the great thing is awareness. We're now aware of what, you know, this can happen. We're aware that it can happen at very young ages, and, you know, how a child might become, you know, abuse opioids is a little bit different than someone who's middle age and has, let's say, had a surgery, and that, those we can change practice by how we manage those using non-opioid pain management modalities.
Professor Danisco, before we went to the break, I know you wanted to make a point following up on what Carrie Milner said regarding a different way, a newer way of looking at things as far as pain management when it comes to opioids. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things is that I wanted to mention before, we are rotating our students for a specialty rotation through the New Solutions Pain Management Center. Beginning in the spring of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel that we really need to get our students ahead of the game because they'll be prescribing next year. And so we're hoping that this project doesn't just reach the College of Nursing, but we have a farther reach and can impact care in the state of Connecticut.
So there is kind of a ramp-up thing here, correct, Carrie, that you're looking at, that this is not going to be a change, as Susan just said, right away. This is going to take a while, correct?
So we have, we have a four-year, the grant's over 4 years. We have a four-year work plan. And the things that we're putting into place right now are educating the primary care providers that we'll be working with at the two federally qualified health centers. We are also collaborating with New Solutions.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at the current pain management policies that exist in both those organizations and getting them up to date because the federal government had a meeting of experts in the field and put out their report this past summer on best practices for pain management for non-cancer pain. So we'll be making sure that we're following best practice policies. So those are like some of the things to get us going, and that we will have, you know, students. I have a student that will be working on this with us, you know, starting right in the fall, so that they can see. Also, what we do in practice is quality improvement. So we track certain outcomes. So, for example, an outcome that we might track in these two federally qualified health centers would be the number of prescriptions for opioids.
Interesting. And the fact that you're doing this right in the Bridgeport, Fairfield areas is great and fascinating. While I have you two ladies with us as we wrap up here, I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, Susan in particular, the prevalence, and I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, but the growing role of nurse practitioners and APRNs and that whole segment of the caregiving fraternity, society, sorority, whatever, there is more and more pressure. I mean, I hear it from my family doctor that she's running around like crazy in two or three different practices. And sometimes I've gone in and I've been taken care of very ably and competently by an APRN or a nurse practitioner. Are we going to see more of that, you think, in the coming years?
Oh, absolutely. That is part of the reason why this grant, this money was given to us by the feds, is because we need to close the gap. There is a shortage of primary care providers. And as the director of the nurse practitioner program here, I know I've been putting out very well-qualified, competent clinicians that can kind of fill that role. Mm-hmm. And I've been providing primary care for 30 years. I'm an old timer, and you know, and I've been doing it well, and patients are very satisfied, and studies show that nurse practitioners do provide excellent care and have good patient care outcomes.
Carrie, your thoughts on that?
I agree with Sue. You know, teaching in a nurse practitioner program, that you will see a lot more of us in the primary care setting, mm-hmm. you know, working to take care of patients.
And the bottom line is, I know daughters of friends and relatives of mine who have gone into it. And listen, ladies, bottom line is there are jobs available out there too, correct? I mean, they're looking to hire, right? APRNs nurse practitioners, correct?
Correct.
Yes, and it's very rewarding, and both of us have daughters who are nurses.
Yes.
They're registered nurses now, and so we're encouraging them
to become nurse practitioners.
To go to the next level, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And they won't, and think about it this way, you can homeschool them on that. How great would that be?
we debrief an awful lot.
Listen, great to talk to you folks about $2.4 million grant from the HRSA to forward a better look at pain management. The fact that you're doing this in the Bridgeport area, wonderful. Professors Susan Danisco and Carrie Milner, both from the College of Nursing at Sacred Heart University. Ladies, thank you. We appreciate the time
here.
We really do.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Call back anytime. We appreciate it. There you go. All right. $2.5 million coming from the feds to help the College of Nursing at Sacred Heart to maybe not rely so often, right, on opioids. And we hear over and over again the medical profession trying as best as it can to back off on this stuff. Yes, some people need opioids. Yes, there is some severe pain that can only be managed with opioids. But other than that, there's a concerted effort to ease off on it. We always talk about a lot on this show how the state of Connecticut runs, right? It's got to run. It's got to function. You folks who run households or run businesses, you've got to make sure that the place is up and running. I mean, what offices are doing, what the whole administrative specter of the state. Sounds like a hellish job. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Our next guest is the commissioner of the Department of Administrative Services, which has a big say in how the state runs. And you'd probably say, oh, yeah, DAS. I heard of that. Well, Commissioner Josh Jabal joins us. Commissioner Paul here in Bridgeport, how are you?
I'm well, Paul. Thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Well, you had a you had some pretty nice gigs in the private sector. What made you want to take this one? Because most people would say, "Are you kidding me? Run the state of Connecticut? No, thank you." But you stepped up here. What made you do that?
Yeah, well, it was a couple of factors. I mean, I've born and raised in Connecticut, moved out of the state for a few years, mid-career, work-related moves, but my wife and I came back to raise our families, and you know, I was at a point in my career where, you know, had some success in the private sector, had sold the company, and you know, was asked to serve and view this as an important time. You know, our state is making changes that are needed to correct for several decades of irresponsible budgeting, and I think we're turning the corner. And I really believe in this state, and I felt like when asked, it was my responsibility to step up and serve, particularly given my thoughts that I had some experience that could help, and the governor's vision to do some things differently up here that I thought could really make a difference.
You know, heaven praise you for using the word, Commissioner, irresponsible. And I know that's a harsh word, but as you're a native of this state, as I'm a native of this state, I've spent my entire life, say, for my college years here, people who call this program and programs like this all around the state, the one thing, Commissioner, they always say is, can you just be responsible with how you run the state and how you spend my tax money?
Yeah, you know, it's a simple principle, right? Like we need to think about state's finances in the same way we think about, you know, running a business or a family thinks about running its own finances. And we're trying to, you know, ensure that everything we do up here is spending taxpayer money like we'd spend our own. And, you know, I think what you're seeing out of this governor and this administration are definitely steps in that direction. You know, there's actually a great piece in the Connecticut Mirror today, if people haven't seen it, about the budget surplus and the rainy day fund, which is hitting all-time record highs right now. And they make reference back to, I think, the Roland years, the last time the rainy day fund was quite flush. It was actually much smaller than it is now. But they were spending the surplus by sending rebate checks to people. Folks may remember this.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they were not making the proper contributions into the state pension plan and resulting in these huge unfunded liabilities, which we're now having to deal with. So in contrast, now we're making the proper contributions into the pension plan. We're digging out of that hole. We're not spending it on new programs. We're socking it away. We're holding the line on taxes and getting the state going in the right direction.
You said you were in the private sector. You had your own company. You also spent 11 years at IBM. And if there was ever a company, Commissioner, that, you know, kind of typifies that American white collar, you know, built on granted companies, you know, one of them is, I think we'd have to agree, where you worked at IBM. What are some of the maybe the two or three principles that you try to carry from that gig over to this one?
It's a great question. Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, at any business or any organization you're part of, it's about the people, right? You can only do so much yourself. You have to be surrounded by a strong team who shares a mission and is committed to trying to move that mission forward. And so, you know, one of the things that attracted me to serving in this administration is I think when you look around a lot of the other commissioners and the other people that the governor's brought in, it's a really high quality group, and it's not kind of the usual suspects. You know, I'm one of only of many people from the private sector who kind of have their first government job in these new roles where we're trying to bring in some outside perspectives and some private sector best practices to help the state. So that's one big one. And then, you know, the other is, again, back on responsible budgeting, right? You know, when you run a really large organization, you have to be very careful with major investments. You have to be very careful with your customers and how you treat your customers. And then you say, well, you're the state government. Who are your customers? Well, the customers are the citizens of this state and the businesses of this state who we provide services for. And we need to do a better job of listening to them and what they want and how we serve them in the fashion in which we do that.
Commissioner Josh Jabal joins us. He's the commissioner of the Department of Administrative Services. Commissioner, as I said in the intro, a lot of people may see and read and hear about DAS on TV or on shows like this or online or in their favorite paper. What exactly does the DAS do? What are your kind of macro responsibilities in overlooking the flow of how the state runs?
Sure. Well, we provide most of the business functions of how the state runs. So things like our technology, our real estate and facilities and construction services, human resources for the state, procurement-related activities, and a wide range of other kind of smaller business functions.
When you sat down your first day on the job and you rolled up in back of the desk and you took a breath and said, okay, here we go, what were one or two of your first things, top of list, you know, top sticky note on the pad? What did you tear into right away?
Well, it was just starting to get to know the team. As mentioned before, I think it's really important to understand the folks you're working with, understand their experiences and strengths and what they're trying to get done. But I think, related to, the scope of our department, I really wanted to dig in on the technology side. That's where I've spent my career in the technology industry. It's to a large extent why the governor wanted me in this role is because he has a very ambitious agenda for modernizing how the state operates and bringing in technology to increase efficiency, to provide better services to citizens and to businesses. Today we're pretty disjointed and behind the times in that regard, and so we have a lot of work to do to get caught up, and that's really where we wanted to get started.
Yeah, and I'm stunned, Commissioner, and I'm sure you were, coming from the tech background, that you and I read these stories about, well, this system can't talk to that system, and this department has 30-year-old software, and that department has 20-year-old, DOS software, and here we are at our offices, my studio here in your office, and we've got the newest and best. That had to be high on the list as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I want to be clear, too. In Connecticut, I think sometimes we're pretty hard on ourselves, right? We beat ourselves up pretty good.
You think?
These challenges, though, as I've gotten to know some of my peers in the other states and done research, we're not alone. I mean, this is actually quite the norm with regards to state government around the country. But that said, we know that we can and need to do better. I think, all of us have increasing expectations about what we should be able to do online and how easy it should be, whether that's online shopping or online banking, and we want to deliver that same type of experience for the citizens of Connecticut when they're interacting with the DMV, or if you lose your job and you're looking for the unemployment or job training or other benefits that are available, that type of experience and the ability to access those services online at your convenience without having to go into offices and wait in long lines, that's what we're driving towards here.
And Commissioner, I asked you before, I want to follow up on this. What are some of the things now, maybe one or two items that you want to let listeners know about that maybe that you've been working on recently that are going to help the state function better?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the governor has given us all a very clear directive that we want to look at every opportunity to streamline government operations, make things more efficient, and reduce the cost structure of state government. And so we've made a few announcements recently. In fact, one just yesterday, we announced that we're undertaking an initiative to centralize and streamline the state's human resources function. So currently, HR is provided separately in each of the executive branch agencies. They all have their own HR departments, and that results in a lot of inefficiency, as you can imagine. And so we're undertaking an initiative to bring them all together, to specialize those teams. About 38% of the people in that function retire over the next 3 years, we'll be in a position to save about $10 million per year. Another announcement we made recently is that we signed a new statewide agreement with Microsoft. So like a lot of businesses, we rely a lot on Microsoft products for email and for PowerPoint and Excel and all that good stuff. Previously, state agencies have been contracting with Microsoft separately on their own, and those costs were escalating, and obviously we weren't leveraging the purchasing power of the state by doing that all in one go. And so we negotiated with Microsoft to rip up those agreements, sign one new statewide agreement, which gets us more discounting, again, saving the taxpayers money, also getting better tools into the hands of our employees that'll make them more productive and moving the whole thing up to the cloud. So, you know, not the sexiest stuff necessarily, but, you know, for people who care about ensuring that each tax dollar is being spent wisely and we're trying to reduce the cost structure of government, hopefully put a smile on your face.
Well, it's not, you know, Commissioner, it's not sexy, but again, there are people in Fairfield County here in New Haven listening to me going, wait a minute, the state had each department with an HR department and getting their own software. And I'm sure people are saying, you know, hallelujah, one big company like Connecticut, you know, get discounts on the software and have a streamlined HR system. Again, like you and I see in the private sector.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the good news is we can make progress in state government by applying, you know, a lot of these private sector best practices. You know, it just takes work, it takes determination, it takes having the right people in these roles, and, you know, I think we're going to make a lot of progress in the coming years.
Your office, obviously, you alluded to it a couple of times in our chat here so far, the state employees, and I know that there are so many branches, and you have unions to deal with, and you have, as you said, retirements coming, some early retirements and everything. So that's kind of got to be for you a delicate minefield as you look for efficiencies, correct? You also have to keep in mind that, you know, you're dealing with state employees who are unionized. And frankly, I'm sure many of them have, or at least their leaders, have made concerns that they have known to you.
Sure. Well, look, I mean, we share a dynamic here where, under the current state employees agreement, there's a term that in about 3 years from now, a little less than 3 years from now, for people who are retirement eligible, the formula for the cost of living adjustments to their pension changes pretty negatively. And so, most everyone's in agreement that anyone who's retirement eligible at that time will, in fact, retire before that date. So we have pretty clear line of sight to the fact that we're expecting about a third of the executive branch full-time workforce to retire in less than 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so that's a huge number, right? If you run a business and you think about a third of your employees being getting ready to walk out the door, it's a huge risk, right? It's a lot of institutional knowledge that's going to leave. But, you know, we're also looking at it as a huge and really exciting opportunity to reinvent how we do a lot of things, to look at different skills that we may need, and ultimately to spend the time between now and then re-engineering processes, streamlining things, bringing in technology where we can automate repetitive tasks, all in an effort to try to drop some of those savings to the bottom line and improve the state's cost structure.
You know, finally, Commissioner, I want to wrap this up by asking you something, and I'm not asking you, obviously, to divulge anything in confidence, but for people who don't know, but you've dealt with them, what is Governor Ned Lamont like in a one-on-one situation when you're just discussing the business of the state? For people who just know him by, you know, what they hear on newscasts, on radio, or on TV, or read the quotes in print, what should they know about him?
You know, he is, and, you know, I say this in all sincerity, he is really one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. He is absolutely doing this for all the reasons that you hope people go into public service, you know, not for ego or you know, for prestige or some politicians go in it for money.
Well, he doesn't need the money. We know that.
He just wants to do everything he can to have a positive impact on this state, and, you know, with the consequences be damned in terms of his popularity, right? And so you see him doing things like, you know, trying to work on our long-term transportation infrastructure and tolls, and that's an issue where, you know, the benefits of that, if it's enacted, you know, won't even accrue during his administration. So he's putting all his political capital into something that'll benefit future generations, and that's the kind of person that he is. He's sincerely curious. He's always asking questions. He wants to learn, wants to surround himself with people with interesting points of view. I think he's a really impressive person.
Well, Commissioner, thank you. We appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we'll have you on many times in the future. If anything is new or big in your office, have your folks call my folks, and my folks consists of me. That's it. So you'll be getting me, and we'll have you back on. It's been great.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Appreciate All right. Thanks. It. Appreciate it. Thanks, Commissioner. We appreciate it. Commissioner Josh Jabal, G-E-B-A-L-L-E, Josh Jabal of the Department of Administrative Services.